Today is July 29th, 2005, and this is Adam Gregg interviewing Dallas Crowe about his World War II experiences. Okay, Dallas, can we start out, and could you state your full name?
My full name, middle name and all.
Sure.
Dallas Leroy Crowe.
Okay, and the place and date of your birth?
January 7th, 1924, Chatsworth, Iowa.
Okay, and where did you live as you were growing up?
I lived in Chatsworth till the first grade. Then we moved out on the farm where Glenn has got his cattle yard on the west side of old Highway 12. We lived there for a couple of years. And then we moved up north of Haywarden where the water tower is at up there. We lived on that farm for about 4 years. And then we sold out and we moved to Stevens, South Dakota. You know where that's at?
I don't.
That's North Sioux City. And I forget the name of the school just north of there. But I went to school up there and graduated from the eighth grade there. Then we moved back to Chatsworth again. And then before school started, we moved to Haywarden, and I started high school here in Haywarden and graduated here from Haywarden.
Okay. And before you went into the war, did you work anywhere?
Just odd jobs, more or less. Nothing great. I got out of high school and I worked for Malarkey's Dairy 1 week. That was enough of that. I worked for the Bach and Silo for John Harmelick, 25 cents an hour. Good job. That didn't last too long either. But I wasn't out of school a year and I was in the service. Graduated in May, you know, and then next March I was in the service. So.
Okay. And how would you describe your experience in the years before the war as the country was going through the Great Depression?
Well, I was kind of young at the time, but you kind of realized it. The thing that I remember most is the drought in the middle 30s. That's what I remember most. You can't believe how it could dry up. The old corn just dried up and turned white. I think 1/4 of July, as I recall, it was 114. About 2 days later, the corn was gone. My dad took the grain binder with a platform canvas on it and went out there. That way he could cut two rows at a time. And he cut it in windrows. We loaded it up and hauled it in and run it through a shredder and blew it into the barn. That was the cattle feed for the winter. They were pretty thin. Cows when spring came, I'll tell you. But that was the worst, them drought years. You can't believe what it does. I don't know how, makes me wonder how this hybrid corn and stuff nowadays would take something like that. Just makes me wonder. Best years of my life, though, spent on the farm.
Why is that?
Oh, I liked it. I liked that on the farm. That was great. Had all the animals and stuff, you know. We milked 12 head of cows, separated the milk all by hand. We didn't have running water, electricity, or nothing. Quite an experience. Didn't have a tractor. Farmed with horses. Quite a deal. Liked it, though.
And did you do that through high school?
No. That was after high school. It was in the eighth grade, about the fourth to the eighth grade. And then I didn't finish the eighth grade there when we sold out in March and then went down to Stevens. So it's kind of a fouled up mess right through there.
Why was your family moving around so much at that time?
Oh, it more or less because of the drought years and stuff like that. I can't really tell you how many bushel of corn we had per acre in them drought years, but it was practically zilch. The last year we was on the farm, we figured we had a bumper crop, and we had 50 bushel corn. I was in the 8th grade, and I'd take a team and wagon and go out in the field pick corn right alongside my dad. Mm-hmm. Ain't many kids do that today. Kind of fun.
So at this time, were you paying attention to what was going on over in Europe? This is towards the end of the 1930s, but as war was breaking out in Europe before the U.S. got involved?
No, not. A kid just don't do that. I don't think they pay that much attention to it. They realize it, but they don't pay the attention to it. I was real surprised when Pearl Harbor got bombed. It just made you wonder. And it was just about, what is Glenn, an uncle to you?
Grandpa.
Grandpa, just like he said. It was all gung-ho and ready to go. You'd think you could whip the world. Till you got in there and found out different.
Do you remember where you were when you found out about Pearl Harbor being attacked?
I suppose it's in school, right here in town, living in town there. Your grandpa and I were schoolmates.
Yeah, that's what he told me.
Yeah. Kind of far-fetched schoolmates. I mean, his interests and my interests are kind of different. I played football, he played basketball. Most of the time, every night during my junior and senior year, I set pins at the bowling alley on weekends. Made pretty good money, 2 cents a line.
So what were your feelings when America was attacked at Pearl Harbor?
I really can't tell you now. That's too long ago. But it was just about like everybody else. Everybody was ready to go. There were no holdouts of any kind.
And when you did join the military, were you drafted or did you enlist?
I got drafted.
What were your thoughts then? Do you remember?
My thoughts then, I wanted to go into the Navy. And I don't know how it was, but I must have registered for the draft or something down in Sioux City or some way. Anyway, I got drafted through Sioux City and we went to Camp Dodge. And the guy told me in there, he says, we need some nice young guys in the Army too. So that's where I wound up.
Why did you originally want to go into the Navy?
Oh, man, they have a nice clean bed to sleep in every night. White sheets. Don't get that in the Army.
So where were you living at the time you were drafted? Were you in Hayward?
Yeah. Yeah, I was in Hayward then.
Do you recall your first days in service?
Well, we went down to Camp Dodge, and that's where we took all our physicals and got issued all our clothes and stuff. And then we got shipped out, and I got shipped down to Camp Polk, Louisiana. And it took a while to get everybody in there. You had to have a new cadre and stuff, and they came out of Kentucky. So you had to get all your officers and stuff in line, and finally got it all together and finally wound up a company. About 150 guys, I think, or so in the company. But it wasn't all bad, I didn't think. Yeah, I kind of enjoyed it in a way. Sure, you had tough days, but you had some pretty good ones too once in a while. Some of them were kind of dull, and again, they get a little exciting once in a while too. Never too many dull moments.
What was a tough day like for you?
tough day.
Yeah.
Just like on that citation there, that presidential citation. Now that was tough. Because I was up on a Monday morning, you might say. That evening, they took me over to a combat engineer outfit. About midnight, we loaded onto a truck and headed for the river. And we got down the road, sat there, and then all at once the artillery opened up. And I mean artillery opened up. The truck would vibrate and start shaking off the road, and you'd have to pull it up and get it back on the road. And that kept up for about an hour or two. And then we went down to the river. And myself and those combat engineers, we were supposed to put a cable across the river. Well, this rural river, they'd broke a dam on it, and the current was between 4 and 5 miles an hour, and that is absolutely fast. We never did get it across. And then my buddy showed up with my truck, and we had a big power boat behind it, and we got that in the water, and he and I, we put the cable across. That day, that night, we built a trestle bridge. Went across the pontoon bridge and built a trestle bridge. Well, it was just starting to break day when they come back across on that. Lieutenant stopped us. He was going to build a bridge and needed help. He took us up to his bridge. We worked all day up to about 9 o'clock that night. No sleep, no eat, or nothing in all that time. That's a long haul. That's a tough day. That's a tough day.
If we could go back to your first days, how did you feel about joining the military?
Oh, I was just like your grandpa. I was gung-ho, ready to go. Everybody kind of was, yeah. Yeah. You didn't have anybody wanting to back out or anything.
How did they train you for your specific job?
Well, we was a bridge. We built the floating pontoon bridge. And that's what we had the equipment and stuff there, and that's what we trained on. I don't know if you've ever seen one of them or not.
I think I have, yes.
And I think if I can unplug for a minute, I might have a picture of one.
Sure, I can stop the tape just for a moment. Wallace Crowe, and he's talking about his experience, his training experiences and learning how to build the bridges. Go ahead, Dallas.
Well, that's what we had there. And like that paper clipping I gave you that lists all the trucks and stuff we had, well, we had 36 of them, and that hauled nothing but what that pontoon bridge. They had two pontoons and what they call one section a treadway, which is two pieces 12 feet long. And we had 36 of them, and we had combat engineers actually did more of the building than anything else. We hauled equipment and unloaded it and helped. We knew how to assemble it. We could show them how. That's it. That's what it looked like. You ought to see the new ones. The new pontoon bridges now. Made of aluminum. And they fold up like a W. And they unfold like that and lock. Solid tops on them. Gee, they're nice.
What were these made of?
They were kind of a rubberized canvas. And they had I suppose, 6 or 7, maybe 8 sections to each one, and there was a big round loop like that, and then they had what they called a sausage that laid in the middle. And then you had plywood top that went on there and strapped on. And then your treadway set on top of that.
And what was your job then with those? Were you to get them to the river, or what was your job?
I had a maintenance truck. I had a little bit of everything on there, outboard motors and wrenches and ropes and cable and that, most anything you could use to build that bridge with. And I never really did much until I got done, and then I'd have to help lay the anchors and tie all four corners off and put anchors on. And you anchored upstream and downstream both. Because them big tanks, they went across it. Big old army tanks, they'd cross it. But you had to have it pretty solid. That's where I almost got in trouble, laying them anchors. They were 100-pound Navy-type anchors. That's the big thing with a cross on the bottom and stuff. And they got a big spade on two sides. And we'd tie the rope on the pontoon and lay the anchor and the extra rope on the back end of this, our powerboat. My buddy would head upriver with it, and I'd hang on to that sucker and pull her real tight and then let her go. That's when I got in trouble that one time. When I let it go, that spade hooked into my side pocket of my jacket. Just about took me. I hung on. When I finally got done, I didn't have no front in my jacket. It ripped the whole front out of it. But I didn't get wet.
So on that day on the Ruhr River, what was your job during that time? What were you doing?
Well, I supposed to went down there that first trip with them combat engineers and put the cable across. We worked all day and never got it across. And to help matters, we worked in the smoke screen. They laid down a smoke screen that morning when it started to get daylight and kept her going all day. But otherwise, about the same thing. Got in, stayed with in my truck. Guys would come and get stuff for helping build the bridge. It pretty impressed the bridge, really. You get them treadway together, and they'd take them like that and four pontoons together and 24 foot of treadway. Well, to hook the treadway together, they had pins, just a long straight pin, 90 pounds. A 90-pound pin in each one of those treadways. Took a little muscle to do the job. But laying the anchors and tying it off and finishing it up, that was a job for my buddy and I. He was a boat operator. He might have been a year older than I was, but he had his pilot license for the Mississippi River. So he could run a boat. He was good. Good drinker too. He could drink. Taught me how.
So when you got into intense situations like that time on the Ruhr, did you feel that you had been well trained?
Oh yeah. Yeah, we had no problem at all. We knew what we was doing. Yeah.
So, do you remember when they sent you overseas? What were the circumstances around that?
Well, we took our basic down there in Camp Polk. And after we'd taken that, it was just automatic. Well, we loaded up on the railroad cars, you know, train, and headed up to Camp Polk, or Camp, what is it, New Jersey up there, Camp Kilmer, New Jersey, and that's where we left there. But we got up there, and they'd lost the records of all our shots and everything else, so we wound up sitting up there for 2 weeks taking shots and getting lined up again to get our records straightened out. And then we crossed. Went across on the Aquitania, that sister ship to that Lithuania that sunk by hitting the iceberg. I forget now, it had at least three stacks, maybe four stacks on it. We crossed the Atlantic in 7 days. went across in 7 days. Took 14 to get back. Yeah, landed in Glasgow, Scotland. Went from there down to Congleton, England. And then we went down to Newquay, England. I got a map here of England if you get lost. So went down there, and then we started picking up our equipment, going here and there and picking up trucks and all the bridge equipment and all this and that. Would you believe some of the guys got the same trucks over there that they had in basic training? Kind of amazing. But there probably wasn't a lot of them around. They were big Brockway trucks, bridge trucks. They got about 1.5 to 2 miles a gallon on gas. Great big old lumbering suckers. But then from there we shipped out of Plymouth on the invasion force. That was a sight. You ought to have seen that.
Tell me about it.
Man, you can't believe the number of ships that was in that channel out there, and how so many of them had these dirigibles or balloons hanging up above them. But that was just more or less for anti-aircraft. Aircraft security is about what that was for. But, oh, that was a mess of them. But we didn't get in the first day. I think we were supposed to, but they didn't have a bridgehead. They couldn't, or a beachhead, whatever you want to call them. They hadn't got off the beach yet. They couldn't take any more. But I heard on TV here, on that History Channel not too long ago, well, here along about the first of the month, the anniversary of that invasion. Do you know how many casualties they had on that day?
I know it was just unbelievable.
Somewhere in the neighborhood between 10 and 11,000. It makes you wonder how they ever pulled it off. But it was a mess. It was a mess when we went in too, just like I said there in the paper. You know, there were still guys floating in the water and laying on the beach and stuff. And they had a colored... See, we were segregated yet. And they had a colored outfit that was cleaning up the beach. They was picking them up and stacking them like cordwood. It's pretty gruesome, really. But we drove off. We got on what they call a rhino ferry, what is nothing but a big old raft. We got on that. We couldn't get in close enough with the LST. So they put us on a ferry, on that rhino ferry, and run us in, and we got off on that. But we drove right on across the beach and up out of there. We was briefed to go 7 miles. We only went 3. And that was far enough. The machine guns were rattling and rifles barking and artillery was cutting loose. You knew you was there. That's when you got scared, because you knew you couldn't go back. You knew you was there. Only one way to swim after that. You was stuck. That brought you around to your senses pretty fast. But we were supposed to build a bridge, and they figured we'd be blowed up. But the 101st Airborne, they saved the bridge, so we didn't have to build it. So all we did, we just sat around. We didn't do nothing for a couple of weeks or so. And then we figured if we built that bridge, what they figured then, that there might be 50% of the company left if there was that much. Whatever was left was going to go home. But we didn't have to build it, so we all stayed. We stayed till the end. We followed old Patton one time. We followed him till we run out of gas. Had to stop, wait for the supplies to catch up. That was in northern France. And we built a bridge on the Seine River. Built out to an island. Built out to an island, then went from that side on across. Only river we didn't get to build was the Rhine. They didn't let us build that. Meuse River in Belgium. That was a nice one. We didn't have enough equipment in our company to make it all the way across. We had to send one platoon back and get another load of equipment. That was a long sucker. I thought it was 300 and some feet across that river, but it was just a slow-moving river and flat and nice. That's the one I almost went to the bottom at. But that was a really something, that bridge. That was the longest one we ever built. But we built on the Weber River up in Germany, and then the Elbe River. There's another thing, if I could find my book on that. I got a picture of my truck sitting there on the road. That was the last bridge we built. We was only about 40 miles out of Berlin then. We got pinned down for about a half a day with small arms fire under that one. That's kind of scary too. Them suckers buzz about like a hornet. But I never had a problem otherwise. Never got nicked or nothing, huh?
Can we talk a little bit about the preparations for the Normandy invasion? What was that like over in England?
There were so damn many people on that, I wonder that island didn't sink. Oh, man. Every place you went, I mean, it was just loaded with military. But we got down there at Newquay. Well, then we had to get our equipment. So you'd take seven or eight guys, and you'd probably go up to Liverpool or Manchester or someplace and pick up a half a dozen trucks, and then somebody else would take a convoy of them big trucks like that and go pick up bridge equipment. And it was just a night of coming and going. I was with the supply sergeant, and we'd be gone a week at a time just out picking up supplies. And we got them all picked up and seen quite a bit of England. All up and down the west side. I never got over on the east side and never got into London or anything like that, but it was all up and down that east west side. Had that pretty well so I could run it without a map. But yeah, England was a pretty good place. I didn't mind that at all.
Did you ever try to get back?
No. One place I'd really like to go, I'd like to go back to Omaha Beach, and I'd like to see that cemetery they got there in Normandy. From what I hear, it is really something, really nice. But I'd like to go back over and see that part of it, but that's out of sight. Too old to be doing that now. Traveling days are over.
Well, let's keep talking about that Normandy invasion. What was it like to cross the channel?
Well, we had to hold up a day because the storm went through, and it was rough. So they held it up a day. But otherwise, as far as crossing the water and stuff, there was nothing much to that. They gave us some pills and stuff. They said they were seasick pills, but I had my doubts in a lot of ways. Maybe they were, but it seemed like everybody that took one of them was all gung-ho and hopped up and ready to fight. Brave as all get out. Not me. I didn't take any.
So when did you say you arrived on Omaha Beach?
We went in the second day. I don't know how you call it, D1?
D1 or D2, I don't know for sure.
D1 would be would that be the same as D-Day?
I'm not even sure.
Anyway, it's second day.
And what was the situation on Omaha Beach at that point?
Well, they had pretty well had her in hand, and they had a beachhead then built back about 3 miles. So we had a little room to operate on and get more guys in there, and finally they busted out and turned Patton loose, I guess. He made a run.
And you mentioned kind of a gruesome scene on the beach there.
Yeah.
What was that like for you?
That opened your eyes. I think that changed you from a kid into manhood, probably. Yeah, it wasn't good.
You mentioned that was the first time you really had experienced the fear. How did you handle that?
Oh, I don't know. You just lived with it, because I think all the rest of them was probably a little bit that way, too. It was just something you had to take, and that was it. Because there wasn't no turning back. He was going ahead, and that was, he knew that. No, it wasn't all bad, but wasn't as bad as some of them.
You mentioned you came under some small arms fire. Can you describe that for me?
You can hear it, but you can't see it. And you can hear the dang bullets. They buzz pretty good. All you do, you take cover and let somebody weed them out. That's what we did up there on the Elbe River. We pretty much just took cover and had a tank come up, and an infantry guy come up and look the situation over, and they finally located them across the river, and infantry guy set up his mortar, and he dumped in about 3 rounds right in where they was at, and up come the white flag right now. They didn't mess around. After them mortar guys, they're just like shooting baskets. Yeah, they quieted them down right quick. It took a while to find them. They was over there behind the dike. It took a little while to find them. Had one fellow that was on an anti-aircraft gun, a 90mm anti-aircraft gun, sitting off to the side of the bridge. He got nailed. First shot out of the box, they nailed him. But I could see why. He could probably level that gun down, that 90mm. He might have tore up their dike. Yeah, it's kind of scary and stuff, but try to figure out where it comes from. It's a big item.
And what about coming under artillery fire? What would you do to survive that?
Oh, that really ain't so bad. Usually, if you hear it, you're safe. It's already went over you. And you can usually see them where they land and stuff. Get the heck out of the way.
Did you ever come under air attack?
No. No. Shot up a German fighter, though. I drew smoke on him. He come cruising by about this time of day, kind of late in the afternoon. And he come cruising by, probably about as far away as Thunderbird Drive down there. Big swastika on the side of his plane. It was a Messerschmitt ME-109, I think they call them, fighter plane. And I had a 50 caliber machine gun on a turret on my truck. So I just jumped up there and swung around and pressed the buttons, and smoke started coming out of him. You got on those 50 calibers, every fifth shell is a tracer, and they light up, and that's what you aim with. You watch the tracer, watch him go right into the side of the plane. So I had him dead to rights. Brought smoke out of him. Down the line, a couple of more 50s opened up, and down he went. First jet plane I ever seen had a swastika on the side of it, too. Man, could they go. Unreal. You just couldn't believe it the first time you seen them, how fast they could go.
What do you suppose was your greatest fear during your time in the service?
My greatest fear? I have no idea. Just about like everybody else, don't want to get shot up. You like to stay clean if you can. That would be the only thing that I know of, otherwise didn't have.
What influenced you to fight or to keep going day to day? In other words, what motivated you?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know what it would be, to tell you the truth. Just one of those things, I guess, you just keep going. American troops, they don't lose, so. You know, victory is ahead of you someplace along the line.
What were your feelings toward the enemy?
Oh, I don't know. One time they brought three German prisoners around when I was on guard duty, and I was on guard duty at the CP, that's a command post tent, and they brought them in, and here they are, little kids, about 15, 16 years old, and they brought them in there probably about 4 o'clock in the morning, and God, it was cold, and they were shivering, and there was an apple tree there, and they wanted to know if they could eat some of the apples, so, yeah, it didn't make me any difference. Just young kids. Yeah. Kind of felt sorry for them in a way. But the average German, no. I didn't hate them or nothing. All the German towns and stuff, usually you could make friends with most of them. They were all pretty good people, really. I don't think they really believed in the war either, the average German. Of course, Hitler's boys, they believed in it. Yeah, we was in that Battle of the Bulge. We got rolled out at midnight. Had about 5 minutes to get out and get our trucks and get gone. So, without getting caught, so we got out. We got out of that. I think that was right on Christmas Eve or sometime right in there when that happened. I know we had Christmas dinner about 3 days later.
What was it like during the Battle of the Bulge?
Well, it was about like any other day as far as that goes. We never got into any combat fighting, really. Because nobody ever said, but I think being a bridge outfit that we were, I think we were a specialized outfit. We had the same guys from basic training right on through, never changed. And I think we're pretty well protected. We didn't have to get into the thick of things too much.
A lot of things I've read about the Bulge, that was just the weather. Can you describe that for me?
It's in the wintertime. Snow on the ground. Cold, man, about like it is here. That was something else, trying to keep warm. We stayed in a in a place that had a moat all the way around it. Kind of like a castle deal. We stayed in that one winter. And then, where was we at? We was there a day near 2 winters. We stayed in a place, too, up around Aachen, Germany, 1 winter. We stayed there quite a while. Things didn't move very fast in the wintertime. It's just plain cold. You try to stay warm. We'd even have fires out on the guard post. I never figured it out, just what it was, the stuff they had. It was so hard to get it started and everything. And heck, all it is charcoal. Like the charcoal briquettes, that's what we had. We try. Them are hard to start when you don't have the right stuff. But they don't burn with a big high flame or nothing like that. They just go and give off quite a bit of heat. They worked out pretty good.
Were you aware of what was going on then during that Battle of the Bulge?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. We was pretty well informed on that. You bet. They broke through that. They had a whole bunch of American equipment and uniforms and the whole ball of wax. They was hard to tell apart. But they finally got them.
And where was your unit at that time during the Bulge?
I couldn't tell you what town or what it was. I just can't tell you that. I don't know.
Throughout the whole war, were there many casualties in your unit?
One. We was staying in a Catholic school. And, of course, the latrines, you know, they dig a slip trench about so wide and so deep, so long. Put a canvas up around it and stuff. And there was a guy out there in that when we got strafed. And they got him. I happened to be inside the building at the time. I was upstairs. I was coming down the stairs. The stairs went down, and then you went over and come back down this way. And I was just coming down those stairs when they hit. So, but he was outside. And I went out. I helped carry him out to the ambulance. But that... No, we lost another one, but it wasn't enemy. It was an enemy deal. They have what we call them Polak houses. But what they was Polish people that Germans would take prisoners and they brought them back in for labor and stuff. And there was one of those places there. And this was after the war was over. And they had a ruckus over there at that house. And the officer of the day and one of the guards so went over there to see what was going on. And here it was, a colored boy was in there all drunked up, raising Cain. So the lieutenant, who's officer of the day, he took his gun and told him to go back to his unit and he'd bring his gun over to him tomorrow. Well, I don't know what happened, but the fella left. Lieutenant got things quieted down and everything else. Came down to leave the building as he stepped outside. Here's the colored boy, and he had another gun, and he pumped him full of lead. And he was the guy that made second lieutenant from field rank. He took basic training with us guys and everything else. pretty sad deal. Right on the end of the war and stuff like that. But I think, I'm quite sure that's the only two guys we lost. We never had any really get hurt or anything like that. So,
what was it like for you to have friends missing or killed?
Well, I don't know. It's one of them things, you know, that happen. And you kind of get hardened into it, I guess. Which probably is good in one way, and another way probably isn't. You don't have the feelings for it like you normally would. So, just one of them things, I guess.
Were you ever in a situation where you killed the enemy?
No. No. Not unless it was that fighter plane that went down. That'd be the only thing, and that wouldn't be direct face-to-face deal or anything. Mm-hmm. So.
There any other memorable experiences that I haven't asked about yet?
You're getting things pretty well covered, I would say.
Tell me about what were your thoughts on the use of the atomic bomb?
Well, I think